And good afternoon. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show. Coming to you from our studios right here in exciting El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Well, another day is fast flying by. It's November 20th, 324th day of the year. Leap year is 325th. Only 41 days remain until the end of this year. You know, the Democratic Party leadership is strutting their stuff, and Queen Pelosi is getting ready for a coronation. Now, she's the one that was strutting around wearing African native scarves to show her solidarity with Black Lives Matter. So if she really supports them, she needs to step down and let a black congressperson take her place as speaker. But she won't do it because she is special, more important than anybody else. Just ask her. Well, on this date in history in 284, Diocletian chose his Roman emperor. 762, during the Anxi Rebellion of the Tang Dynasty, with the help of the Huli tribe, recaptures Luoyang from the rebels. 1194, Palermo was conquered by Henry VI, the Holy Roman Emperor. 1407, John the Fearless, Duke of Burgundy, and Louis Valois, Duke of Orleans, agree to a truce. But 3 days later, Burgundy kills Orleans. 1441, the Peace of Cremona ends the war between the Republic of Venice and the Duchy of Milan. 1695, Zumbi, the last of the leaders of the Quilombo dos Palmares in early Brazil, is executed by the forces of Portuguese Bandeirante Domingos Jorge Vejo. 1739, started the Battle of Portobello between the British and the Spanish during the War of Jenkins' Ear. 1776, British forces landed the Palisades and attacked Fort Lee. Continental Army tucks its tail and runs across New Jersey. 1789, New Jersey becomes the first U.S. state to ratify the Bill of Rights, which it's now turning its back on like everybody else. 1805, Beethoven's on the opera. Fidelio premieres in Vienna. 1815, the Second Treaty of Paris is signed, returning the French frontiers to their 1790 extent, imposing large indemnities and prolonging the occupation by Allied troops for several more years. 1820, an 80-ton sperm whale attacks and sinks the Essex. That was a whaling ship from Nantucket, Massachusetts, 2,000 miles from the western coast of South America. In fact, Herman Melville's 1851 novel, Moby Dick, was inspired by this story. 1845, Anglo-French blockaded the Rio de la Plata, Battle of Vuelta de Obligado. 1861, American Civil War. Succession ordinance is filed by Kentucky's Confederate government. 1910, but Kentucky never fully withdrew from the Union. It was a border state. Supplied both sides. 1910, the American Revolution, the Mexican Revolution, rather. Francisco Madero issues the Plan de San Luis Potosí, denouncing Mexican public Porfirio Diaz, who was president for life. He was a real dictator. Calls for a revolution to overthrow the government of Mexico. This effectively started the Mexican Revolution. 1917, in World War I, the Battle of Cambrai begins. British forces make early progress in an attack on German positions, but are later pushed back. 1936, Jose Antonio Primo de Rivera, founder of the Falange, is killed by a Republican execution squad. Now, the Falange was the sole legal party of the Francoist regime in Spain. It emerged in 1937 from the merger of the Carlist Party with the Falange Española de los Hons and dissolved in 1977 by Adolfo Suarez's transitional government. Let's see. 1940, World War II. Hungary becomes a signatory of the Tripartite Pact, officially joining the Axis parties. The Axis was Germany and Italy, primarily. 1943, Battle of Tarawa. Excuse me. Operation Galvanic begins. U.S. Marines land on the Tarawa Atoll in the Gilbert Islands and suffer heavy fire from Japanese shore guns and machine guns. 1945, in the Nuremberg trials. These trials against 24 Nazi war criminals start at the Palace of Justice in Nuremberg. 1947, the Princess Elizabeth marries Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten, who becomes the Duke of Edinburgh at Westminster Abbey in London. That is the Queen and her consort. 1959, a Declaration of the Rights of the Child is adopted by the United Nations. Laughingly, I think. 1962, the Cuban Missile Crisis ends on this date. In response to the Soviet Union agreeing to remove its missiles from Cuba, President Kennedy ends the quarantine of the Caribbean nation. 1968, a total of 78 miners are killed in an explosion at the Consolidated Coal Company's Number 9 Mile in Farmington, West Virginia. It's called the Farmington Mine Disaster. It's one of the worst in history. 1969, Vietnam War. The Plain Dealer, a newspaper in Cleveland, Ohio, publishes explicit photographs of dead villagers from the My Lai massacre in Vietnam. A photographer, smuggled them out. 1974, the U.S. Department of Justice files its final antitrust suit against AT&T. Suit later leads to the breakup of AT&T and its Bell system. All it did was allow the same owners to make more money. 1974, the first fatal crash of a Boeing 747 occurs when Lufthansa Flight 540 crashes while attempting to take off from Jomo Kenyatta International Airport in Nairobi, Kenya. Out of the 157 people on board, 59 die. 1977, Egyptian President Anwar Sadat becomes the first Arab leader to officially visit Israel, where he meets Prime Minister Menachem Begin, speaks before the Knesset in Jerusalem. He was seeking a permanent peace settlement, and for his pains, he was assassinated by his own people. 1979, the Grand Mosque seizure. About 200 Sunni Muslims revolt in Saudi Arabia at the site of the Kaaba in Mecca during the pilgrimage and take about 6,000 hostages. Saudi government gets help from the Pakistani Special Forces to put down the uprising. 1980, Lake Bennur drains into an underlying salt deposit. A misplaced Texaco oil probe had been drilled into the Diamond Crystal Salt Lake, causing water to flow out into the mine, which eroded the edges of the hole. 1985, Microsoft Windows 1.0 was released. 1989, the Velvet Revolution. A number of protesters assembled in Prague, Czechoslovakia, swells from 200,000. To an estimated 500,000 overnight. 1990, Andrei Chikatilo, one of the Soviet Union's most prolific serial killers, is arrested. He confesses to killing 56 people. 1991, an Azerbaijani Mi-8 helicopter carrying 19 peacekeeping mission team with officials and journalists from Russia, Kazakhstan, and Azerbaijan are shot down by Armenian military forces in Gojevan district of Azerbaijan. 1992, in England, a fire breaks out in Windsor Castle. Damages the castle and causes over £50 million worth of damage. 1993, savings and loan crisis. The U.S. Senate Ethics Committee issues a stern censure of California Senator Alan Cranston for his dealings with savings and loan executive Charles Keating. 1993, Macedonia's deadliest aviation disaster occurs. Avialimpex Flight 110, a Yakovlev Yak 42, crashes near Orad, killing all 116 people on board. 1994, the Angolan government, UNITA, rebels signed the Lusaka Protocol in Zambia. That ends 19 years of civil war, though the next year localized fighting does break out. 1996, a fire breaks out in an office building in Hong Kong. Kills 41, injures 81. 1998, a court in Taliban-controlled Afghanistan declares accused terrorist Osama bin Laden a man without a sin in regard to the 1998 U.S. Embassy bombings in Kenya and Tanzania. 1998, first space station module component, Zarya, for the International Space Station, is launched from the Baikonur Cosmodrome in Kazakhstan. 2003, after the November 15th bombings, second day of the 2003 Istanbul bombing occurs in Istanbul, Turkey. Destroys the Turkish head office of HSBC Bank AS and the British consulate. 2015, following a hostage siege, at least 19 people are killed in Bamako and Mali. A lot of births and deaths on this date in history. Okay. Holidays and observances. 20 in Spain. Internationally, it's African Industrialization Day. Black Awareness Day in Brazil. Children's Day. Christian Feast Days. Agapius, Ambrose, Traversari, Ampelus, and Caius. Blessed Aniceto, Gonzalez Flores, Jose Sanchez del Rio, and companions. These are known as the Martyrs of Cristero War. Bernward of Hildesheim, Dacius of Durostorum, Edmund the Martyr, Felix or Felix of Cornwall, Gregory of Decapolis, can't talk, Blessed Josefata Odoshevshatska in the Ukrainian Greek Catholic Church, Solitor, Octavius, and Adventor, Theonestus of Vercelli. Earliest day was the Feast of Christ the King can fall. November 26th is the latest. Celebrated on the last Sunday before Advent, Roman Catholic Church. National Sovereignty Day in Argentina. Revolution Day in Mexico. Royal Thai Navy Day in Thailand. Teachers Day in Vietnam. Transgender Day of Remembrance in the LGBT community. All right, let's see what else we might have. All right. Well, I talked about Diocletian being proclaimed the emperor. He was actually a soldier who was proclaimed emperor of Rome by the army itself. He was not of the bloodline. 762, Bogu, Khan of the Uyghurs, conquered Luoyang, capital of the Chinese Empire. 1168, Giovanni di Struma, elected anti-pope. 1194, Palermo, Sicily, is conquered by Emperor Henry VI. 1431 was the first meeting of order of the Golden Fleece. During a water shortage in Jerusalem, the Arabs insisted it was because of the Jews making wine. 1616, the Bishop Richelieu becomes the French Minister of Foreign Affairs and the Minister of War. 1637, Peter Minuit, and the first Swedish immigrants to Delaware sailed from Sweden. I talked about Zumbi, the last king of the Cuambo de Palmares in 1695. He was executed. This is in Brazil. And then he was decapitated and his head displayed on a pike because there were legends he was immortal and he would come back and resume his throne. 1755, English minister William Pitt the Elder resigns. He was known as the Great Commoner. He was British Prime Minister. In 1815, the Second Treaty of Paris that I mentioned, France and her allies agree that France is going to pay indemnities after the Battle of Waterloo. And that effectively ended the Napoleonic Wars. Of course, 1817 was the first Seminole War that began in Florida. In 1862, the Confederate armies of Mississippi and Kentucky merge as the Army of Tennessee under General Braxton Bragg. He wasn't the most brilliant military leader, but he was relatively effective. 1866 was the first national convention of the GOP, the Grand Army of the Republic, which was a veterans organization. Membership, you had to prove you had served in the Union Army. 1866, Howard University was founded in Washington, D.C. A Study in Scarlet, the first Sherlock Holmes story, is accepted by publisher Ward and Locke. They paid £25 for that, which was a respectable amount of money for a story. 1894, the U.S. intervenes in Bluefields in Nicaragua. 1902, Jill Lefebvre and Henry Desgrain. Well, as I say, in 1902, Jill Lefebvre and Henry Desgrain create the Tour de France bicycle race. Now, let's see. 1911, the funeral of Paul and Laura Lafarge, the daughter of Karl Marx in Paris, is attended by Lenin. The two socialists, Paul and Laura, died in a suicide pact in the belief that their political usefulness was at an end. I don't know who taught these people all this stuff. 1914, U.S. State Department starts requiring photographs to be on passports. 1917, the first successful tank use in battle at the Battle of Cambrai in World War I. Britain uses this new technology to break through the German lines. 1919, the first municipally owned airport in the U.S. opens in Tucson, Arizona. 1934, Lillian Hellman's Children's Hour premieres in New York City. 1941, Admiral Nomura and Kurusu hand over a Japanese last diplomatic note prior to war breaking out. And in 1941, the German auxiliary cruiser, which was an armed merchant raider, Cormoran, sinks near Australia. In 1944, the first Japanese suicide submarine attack was in Ulithi Atoll in the Carolines. Well, with all having been said, we're going to go to our... We were talking about creatures of the night. And while we believe that the world is... follows certain rules, there are creatures that dwell in the shadows. You might call them ghosts or poltergeist or werewolves or aliens or vampires or any number of other names. And despite what people say, there's a great deal of evidence these things are real. Oh, I guess it was 55 years ago, my parents bought a brand new home. We were the first ones to live in it. And it was on land where nothing had been built before. But the end of the house where my room was built on top of a Native American village. And I had a lot of strange things happen there. I had little blue and green lights that would float around. Fish would disappear out of the aquarium. I'd also find them wrapped up in clothing in my dresser. It was quite interesting. When we left, we were talking about the home on the edge of hell. And it was located in Spokane, Washington. And the story regarding this location began one night, November 1986. Donna Fensel was awakened by the sounds of what she thought was somebody dragging some heavy furniture across the attic floor. She woke up her husband, whose name was Vernon, and told him somebody was after the antiques they had stored in the attic. Well, Grumbling had been awakened from a sound sleep. He sat upright, and when he heard those noises coming from the attic, he was wide awake. Grabbed a baseball bat he kept at the side of the bed and a flashlight from the drawer of a nightstand and started creeping up the attic steps. He told Donna to stay by the telephone, ready to call 911. Well, after exploring the attic, Vernon came back to report there was no sign of burglars or any indication any furniture had been moved. He thought they were woken up by airlocks in the pipes of their old hot water heating system. Maybe he thought it was time to install a new furnace with forced air ducts. Well, this suggestion of what had caused the sound seemed perfectly satisfactory, and after checking to see that their 12-year-old daughter was still asleep, they went back to bed themselves. But the next evening, those sounds came back, louder than before, and unmistakably in the attic directly above their heads. And once again, it sounded exactly like a crew of movers was moving furniture around. But when he went upstairs to investigate, no intruders were seen and nothing had been moved. However, later on that night, they were summoned to their daughter's bedroom by her screams of terror. According to her daughter, she felt something moving in her bed. And when it brushed up against her, it seemed to her to be both cold and furry. She thought it was an animal, maybe it was a rat. For although they'd never been bothered by rodents in their home before, both the parents carefully searched her room for any signs. They were serving as unwilling hosts to a rat or a mouse, and they didn't find any visible traces of any such creature in her room. So they reassured the daughter that she had to have been dreaming. And no sooner were they back in their own beds when her screams brought her rushing back into her bedroom. This time she said something had picked up the end of her bed and slammed it back down several times in succession on the floor. Now, for the second time that evening, they did their best to pacify her and assure her she'd been having a dream. Maybe it was because she had heard those odd thumps and knocks caused by the airlocks in the pipes of the heating system. Well, two nights later, the couple came back from the movies, and they'd barely gotten inside the door when the 18-year-old girl they'd hired to babysit their daughter met him with the frightening accusation her house was haunted, and she said she'd never babysit for him again. Well, when they got her calm, which took some doing, and asked her what she was talking about, she told him how the television set had turned off on its own when nobody was near it. She had heard footsteps upstairs and doors had opened and closed in the second floor bedrooms while she and Amy had sat cowering downstairs in the living room. In fact, after that, Amy refused to go back to her room and was sleeping on the sofa. Well, the husband paid the sitter double to compensate her for her anxiety, but he couldn't accept her analysis that their home was haunted. As he drove her home, he tried to explain about the knocking sound in the pipes and how they could have sounded like footsteps walking around upstairs. Now, she listened. She politely heard him out and finally said, "Look, I know what I heard and I know what I saw. You got a spook loose in your house." Well, clearly he wasn't going to be able to persuade her otherwise, so he chalked the ghost up to two young girls alone at night who permitted themselves to become frightened by strange noises, and then their imaginations had run wild. But when he drove into the driveway of his home, he was surprised to see the upstairs lights blinking on and off. When he rushed inside, he found his wife sitting on the stairs, a sobbing daughter huddled next to her. She said, "I saw it with my own eyes, a gray, shadowy figure coming down the stairs toward us. I screamed and the thing vanished, but it's been turning the lights on and off ever since." Well, over the next week, that shadowy figure was seen frequently moving about in different rooms of the house. Vegetables and cooking utensils would go flying around the kitchen. Appliances would mysteriously turn themselves on and off, and doors would open and shut on their own accord. The morning after some invisible force snatched Amy out of the bed and spun her across the room, they decided they needed to get a priest to come in and bless their house and drive away the evil entity. In the opinion of the couple, their household had been invaded by a demonic entity, and their home had somehow been moved to the edge of hell. But the visit by the priest only seemed to provoke even more violent disturbances. So Vernon, the husband, decided to call a friend of his, Carl Leakwig, former policeman, and ask him to come to spend the night with him and be their bodyguard, so to speak. Well, when Leakwig later wrote a report about the haunting, he said ghost busting had never been in my resume. But I've got an interest in the paranormal, and I was curious to see what kind of things that were really happening, so I agreed to come. Well, he was later dozing in the big armchair being moved to the foot of the stairs when about 3 in the morning he was awakened by noises coming from upstairs. As he moved to investigate, he noticed the air in the house had taken on an eerie chill. With his flashlight in hand, he moved toward the bedroom occupied by 12-year-old Amy, because it was from that room that the sound seemed to be coming. He said, "When I opened the door and scanned the room with my flashlight, I saw little Amy curled up in bed with her back to the headboard, horrified by the weird demonstration going on in front of her." He said the furniture was dancing, the girl's bed was elevated, dresser drawers floated across the room as if they were filled with helium, dolls, books, and other objects were spinning around the room. But as soon as I turned on the overhead lights, the spooky shenanigans stopped. Well, after Vernon and Donna entered the room to calm their daughter, Leakwig followed through on police procedure and checked the furniture and other objects he had seen in motion. He said he couldn't find any wires, strings, or pulleys. "I knew that I myself wasn't strong enough or dexterous enough to make all the furniture move about as I had seen it dancing around the room, so I couldn't perceive how a tiny 12-year-old girl could have done it. Seemed to me like a genuine poltergeist case with the girl, Amy, providing the energy center. Discreetly as I could, I asked her mother about any onset of puberty, and I learned that Amy had been quite upset and frightened with the advent of certain of her new bodily functions. Well, familiar enough with the literature of the paranormal to recognize that so often energy of the poltergeist is set free by a girl entering puberty, he suggested that the mother explained to her daughter in greater detail, with a lot of tender, loving care, the hormonal and other changes that came with her womanhood. And he also suggested the entire family take a few days away from the house on a holiday. He said, "I spent a night in the house after they were away," he wrote in his report. And he said, "There were no manifestations of any kind. And I did a follow-up check after family returned, and I was pleased to learn that everything was quiet once again in her home. All that poltergeistic energy had been spent, and Once Amy came to terms with adolescence and realized things were happening were all right and normal, the haunting seemed to end. But the question is, who was it that was haunting the house? They saw a figure, no question about it. Well, on August 8, 1989, television cameraman Barry Conrad was asked to go with psychical investigator Dr. Barry Taff and a number of other researchers to a reputed haunted house in San Pedro, California. Conrad accepted the assignment in the hope he might be able to capture some authentic paranormal phenomena on videotape. He ended up getting footage that was far more frightening than he could have foreseen in his wildest imagination. The group of researchers arrived at the alleged haunted house. Jackie Hernandez, the woman who'd requested the investigation, told them of lamps and other objects flying around the room, the apparition of a decaying elderly man in a children's bedroom, and a ghostly disembodied head up in the attic. Well, Conrad admitted he considered her accounts to be a bit on the unbelievable side, and Jeff Wheatcraft, the photographer he'd brought to assist him, proclaimed himself a complete skeptic of things ghostly and otherworldly. But pretty soon, that disbelief and skepticism would vanish. Shortly after Wheatcraft ascended to the attic opening by standing atop a washing machine in a small laundry room at the rear of the house, all those assembled below could hear his screams of terror. Something, he said, after he jumped down from the attic, had pulled his Canon 35mm camera out of his hands. Well, as frightened as the former skeptic Wheatcraft was, he joined Barry Conrad in another foray into the attic. The two photographers crawled into the overhead space, videotape rolling, ready to record anything that heaven and earth might be between heaven and earth might be occupying the darkened recesses of the attic. And then, as Conrad Rader said, without warning, his camera went dead. Although he quickly replaced the batteries, the camera remained inoperative. Usually when a battery goes out, the green pilot light changes to red with the picture gradually fading to black. He said later, in this case, the pilot light failed altogether, a highly unusual occurrence. Well, Wheatcraft later found the camera had been taken from him in a dusty old grape box in the northeast corner of the attic. Eerily enough, the lens had been removed and placed in a space just behind the trap door of the attic. Just as then a foul stench permeated the attic space, and Wheatcraft emitted another scream that something was touching him, and he stumbled toward the attic's trap door. Somehow, the two photographers managed to get down from the attic to safety below without falling and injuring themselves. Well, shaken, Wheatcraft stated it felt like a bony hand had applied tremendous pressure to his lower back. Once downstairs, Conrad's camera again began to function. He was able to record what sounded like heavy footsteps of an angry giant thundering across the attic floor. Well, Wheatcraft stood on the washing machine to peer into that attic crawl space again. He shouted that he was seeing three brilliant flashes of light and an eerie black mass the size of three adult men standing side by side. According to Barry Conrad's report, for days afterwards, Jeff Wheatcraft continued to suffer pain in his lower back from the pressure of what had been applied by that bony hand. When he visited a chiropractor, it was confirmed that his lower back had indeed suffered massive internal bruising. A month later, on the evening of September 4th, Conrad got a desperate call from Jackie Hernandez. Says she was undergoing a vicious poltergeistic siege in her home. Soft drink can had been thrown at her while the doors opened and slammed shut of their own volition. The night before, she said, an invisible force had held her down on the floor for several minutes and tried to smother her. Well, Jeff Wheatcraft and another friend, Gary Boehm, happened to be visiting Conrad at his apartment when they all heard Jackie's frantic call. They decided they had to leave at once for San Pedro and do their best to help the beleaguered woman and her two small children. Well, they got to San Pedro about 1 in the morning. At first, everything in the bungalow seemed to be calm, and then Jeff Wheatcraft wanted to show his friend the grape box in the attic where he discovered his camera after being jerked out of his hands. Well, Barry Conrad remained downstairs in the laundry room with Jackie and her daughter Susan. Then, according to Conrad, a bright orange comet of light suddenly flashed before us and flew through a small door that led outside.
Motion detected at the front door.
little moan came from the area of the attic. It was Jeff Wheatcraft's voice crying out. He had to get out of there. It put something around my neck. Well, Barry Conrad wrote that his heart almost froze with fear as I noticed a weathered clothesline cord dangling around from my friend's swollen neck as he stiffly came down from the attic. It was at this instance we all felt the pangs of incredible disbelief. Now, according to his friend Gary, who had come to Wheatcraft's rescue, something had wrapped a clothesline tightly around his neck and then hung Jeff on a nail protruding from one of the rafter beams. Gary later said if I hadn't been there, Jeff would have been strangled in the attic. He didn't know what was going on. The cord was wrapped so tightly, it was very difficult to get him down. In fact, I had to bend the nail in order to release him. Well, Wheatcraft was left with red friction burns encircling his neck as a result of the attack by that vicious entity. Later, when Barry Conrad examined the tapes of that evening, he was startled to observe a bright comet of light traveling through a doorway behind Wheatcraft shortly after the bizarre hanging episode. He said another orb of light could be seen buzzing over the top of Jeff's head while standing in the living room discussing this ordeal. And yet another light was found zooming across the kitchen above Susan moments after Wheatcraft had descended from the attic space. According to Dr. Barry Taff, in the history of paranormal research, there have only been a handful of cases in which phenomena have deliberately, maliciously attacked human beings. And the San Pedro poltergeist case is certainly among that number. Well, when you explore the paranormal, you find that most types of phenomena appear to be universal. The individual circumstances of the accounts fitting themselves to the unique cultural interpretations of whatever area in which they manifest. Certainly, stories of phantom hitchhikers constitute one such category of ubiquitous tales. They've been reported around the world. In fact, stories about Chicago's Resurrection Mary have been floating around since the 1930s. Mary is said to be the spirit of a beautiful blonde Polish girl. She'd been picked up by smitten young men at dances and asked to be taken home. The problem is home always turned out to be Resurrection Cemetery on Archer Avenue on the south side of Chicago. On occasion, the phantom hitchhiker would be bold enough to open car doors and get in, explaining to the startled driver she desperately needs a ride into the city. Once again, as the car approaches the cemetery on Archer, she bolts from the car and vanishes at the gates. When I was in Chicago a number of years ago, I heard a lot of interesting stories about Resurrection Mary. For many years now, taxi drivers in Naha, Okinawa, claimed that an attractive woman in her 20s with short cropped hair dressed in black slacks often hails them for a ride on the road to the U.S. Marine camp. When the cab driver turns around to ask for a specific destination, she vanishes. The Phantom has been dubbed the Night Walker of Nago because she most often appears on the mountain road leading from the fishing village of Nago up to the Marine camp. Since 1965, dozens of drivers have slammed on their brakes to avoid hitting a pretty young woman in a flowing white dress standing in the road on Bluebell Hill in Maidstone, England. The Phantom is said to be that of Judith Lingham, who was said to have been a bridesmaid for her best friend when she died in a car crash the night before the wedding. Her spirit still appears and dressed in her flowing bridesmaid gown. She's still trying to get to the wedding. One truck driver reported that he was crossing Oklahoma late one December night in 1997, was approached by a young man at a truck stop who said that he needed a ride to Tulsa. The driver, whose name was Jack Cleveland, said, sure, get in. I'd been pushing the mileage and the hours, and I was getting a bit groggy in spite of four cups of black coffee he had chugged down. He thought maybe having somebody to talk to would help him stay alert. He described his passenger as being in his late teens, clean-shaven, wore his hair fairly long and parted in the middle. And in spite of the cold night, he only had on a lightweight jacket. Cleveland asked him if he wanted the heater turned up, and the young man said he was comfortable. Cleveland didn't want to be nosy, but he wanted to start a conversation, so he asked him why he was going to Tulsa. Jake was astonished by the young man's answer. He said, I'm going to enlist in the Army. My brother's over there right now in England. I know there's going to be a big invasion soon, and I want to get enlisted and get in on it. Puzzled, Jake asked the teenager what invasion that might be that he wanted to get in on. Well, Jake said the kid looked at him like he was crazy. He said, well, sir, the kind he used, the tone of voice Jake describes is the kind he used for little children or slow-witted folks. If you read the newspapers, you'll just have to know the Allies are going to be invading Europe, maybe France or Italy, and getting old laid off and his crew pretty damn soon. Well, Jake, at that point, took a really good look at his passenger for the first time. In the light from the dashboard, he could see his hair was slicked down with some greasy hair dressing, wore old corduroy trousers and a faded flannel shirt. And there was a rolled-up newspaper in his jacket pocket. Well, against his better judgment, Jake asked him, was that a new paper? He said, sure is. My father gave it to me just before I walked down the lane and started hitching for Tulsa. Well, Jake shifted uncomfortably behind the wheel, and suddenly that cab space in his 18-wheeler seemed to shrink, and in spite of the heat, it was becoming cold. So Jake asked him, what's the date? I kind of lose track when I'm on the road. Kid unfurled the newspaper, and Jack caught a glimpse of a news photo of Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt and a bit of headline about some meeting in Cairo. Teenager read December 4th, 1943. Well, Jake found himself blurting out that was exactly 54 years ago to the day. And then Jake said that that moment that kid looked at him with those very sorrowful eyes. He looked like he was about to cry, but at the same time his eyes just seemed to be piercing as if he was looking right through him. And at some other place way off in time. Well, within the next few moments, Jake saw his strange passions becoming less material in form, almost translucent. His voice was barely a whisper when he said, I guess I'm not going to make it to Tulsa this time either. And then he vanished. Jake said, I'd hoped the kid would give me somebody to talk to and help keep me awake. Believe it when I say I was now as wide awake as I'd ever been in his life. He saw that kid's eyes every night before he went to sleep for months. Well, Jake ended his account by stating he did ask around truck stops in the area about a phantom of a young teenager trying to get to Tulsa to enlist in World War II. But he had no luck in tracking down any other truckers who claimed to have had such an experience. He said later, maybe we just happened to connect that night and come together with our respective moments in time and space. Well, let's talk about, for lack of a better term, manimals. This story begins on the night of October 4th, 1998. Seven hunters are roasting marshmallows around a fire at their camp near Mud Springs. That's a desolate area of Trinity County, about 200 miles north of San Francisco. And as they sat there, they heard a rustling in the bushes. Well, when one of the men got his flashlight, went to investigate, he saw what he described as an enormous man-beast that he estimated to be about 9 feet tall, standing about 50 yards away on the other side of the creek. Later on, two of the hunters told California Department of Fish and Game officials and a reporter from the Reading Record Spotlight that the creature stayed a distance from their campsite most of the night. But it did remain close enough they could hear its eerie screams. Men also stated they were convinced the thing wasn't a bear, because they could see its arms, which hung past its knees. Next morning, the hunters were able to find human-like tracks in the area that measured 6 inches wide and 20 inches long. That's a heck of a foot for anything. Reports of such incredible monstrous mammals, half-human, half-ape-like creatures, appearing to witnesses from out of the darkness have been with us since the demon-haunted days of the Middle Ages. In those days, the giant hairy beings that lived in the forest caves of Europe were believed to be Satan's spawn. The monasteries rang with angered cries about the giant demons with their ugly shapes, bestial faces that had kidnapped villagers and pious monks. Abbots and bishops wrote angry diatribes against these entities and condoned their death when captured. In 840 A.D., Agobard, the Archbishop of Lyons, told of three such demons, as he called them, giant people of the forest and mountains who were stoned to death after being displayed in chains for several days. In his chronicles, Admiral Ralph of Coggeshall Abbey in Essex, England, wrote of a strange monster whose charred body had been found after a lightning storm on the night of St. John the Baptist in June of 1205. He stated that a terrible stench came from the beast that had monstrous limbs. And villagers of the Caucasus Mountains have legends of an ape-like wild man that goes back for centuries. And the same can be said of the Tibetans living on the slope of Mount Everest and Native American tribes inhabiting the northwestern United States. The Gilyak, a remote tribe of Siberian native people, claim that there are animals inhabiting the frozen forests of Siberia that have human feelings and souls. They claim these half-human beasts travel in family units and that their greatest desire is to learn the secret of fire. The human-like creatures, whether sighted in the more remote, wooded, or monstrous regions of North America, South America, Russia, China, Australia, or Africa, is most often believed to be a two-footed mammal that constitutes a kind of missing link between Homo sapiens and the great apes, because its appearance is more primitive than that of the Neanderthal. The descriptions given of these mammals by witnesses around the world are amazingly similar. Height, they're 6 to 9 feet, weight between 400 and 1,000 pounds. Their eyes are solid black, dark fur or body hair from 1 to 4 inches in length. It's said to cover the creature's entire body with the exception of the palms of its hands, the soles of its feet, and the upper facial area, nose, and eyelids. Based on the eyewitness description of hundreds of reliable individuals who have encountered these creatures over the last 50 to 75 years, it would seem them animals are more human-like than ape-like or bear-like. For one thing, the entities are repeatedly said by witnesses to have breasts and buttocks. Neither apes nor bears have buttocks, nor do they leave flat-footed human-like footprints. Well, the question is it possible for such large human-like beings to exist without being fully accredited and cataloged by orthodox zoologists and biologists? In recent decades, we've witnessed the official discovery of a large number of animals previously unrecognized by the experts, although well known by the aboriginal inhabitants of the creature's natural habitats. Although hunters in Kamchatka, Manchuria, and Sakhalin have long been telling exciting stories of the giant carnivorous brown bear they had encountered, European scientists didn't accept the existence of the great bear until 1898. Largest land animal next to the African elephant is the white rhinoceros, which was officially unacknowledged until 1900. The largest of the apes, the mountain gorilla, was considered a silly native superstition until 1901. And the dragons of Komodo Island in Indonesia were considered the creations of a strange myth conjured up by the islanders until 1912. And the British zoologist who described the bizarre royal leopard, the half-leopard, half-hyena beast, long claimed by the natives of Rhodesia to be an actual beast of prey, wondered how such a large animal, and one so distinct from other species, could remain unknown for so long. Well, in June of 1994, the first living specimen of the Vu Quang ox was caught in a rugged area of the Vietnamese-Laotian border, and its verified existence was hailed as a zoological find of the half-century. This horned mammal, weighing over 200 pounds, with cinnamon black and white coloration, is a hemibovid species ancestral to both oxen and antelope that was thought to become extinct 4 million years ago. Zoologists estimated their present population to be in the hundreds. And also, let's not forget the coelacanth, which was caught off the coast of Africa, and it was supposed to have gone extinct 65 million years ago. July of 1999, zoologists saw the first photographic evidence that the Javan rhinoceros, thought completely wiped out on the Asian mainland in the 1960s, still strives some 130 kilometers north of Ho Chi Minh City in the Long Dong province of Vietnam. These huge animals, which can weigh over 3,000 pounds, had somehow been misplaced or missed for nearly 40 years. Well, in December 2000, Thai scientists set out to search the northern jungles of Thailand for conclusive proof of the sightings of large, hairy elephants that witnesses claim strongly resemble the long-extinct woolly mammoth. Now, what these scientists and forestry officials may discover is either a new species of elephant or long-lost descendants of the great tusked mammoth of the Ice Age. Since at this point, nobody's really quite certain whether Bigfoot, Sasquatch, or the the other animals, or animal or human, it should be recalled that no Westerner set eyes on the Petongloon people of northern Thailand until the late 1930s. At the time of their discovery, the Petongluang were assessed as a primitive people possessing no weapons, speaking only monosyllabic experts, and living in a small nomadic family groups. Seemed not to matter at all to them. Their official existence was denied, and they'd been relegated to the mystic corridors of folk myth. But could small bands of humans truly avoid official discovery in the United States? I mean, let's face it. We've got people who go everywhere. In California, though, in 1872, the last of the Yahi tribe gave up their fight against the steadily growing numbers of the white settlers, and rather than surrender, simply disappeared into a small valley on the slopes of Mount Lawson. There, the little community lived in peace until 1884, when the continuous loss of hunting land forced the Yahis to raid the ranchers' cabins in search of food. And remarkable as it might seem, during the next decade of nocturnal raids on the ranchers, the Yahi were seen only one time. Well, in 1894, the last surviving members of the tribe made their home on two pieces of land half a mile wide and 3 miles long. And although they established a permanent camp in an area that was becoming increasingly heavily populated, their presence remained undiscovered until some surveyors happened to them in 1909. In 1911, when Ishii, the last surviving Yahi, walked into a small California town to surrender, it was determined he'd lived on the fringes of civilization for 39 years. In the 4 decades since the Yahi ceased their war with the U.S., tribal members had been seen only twice. Yet Ishii and his people had kept permanent camps, made daily use of fire, and had foraged among the white community, even conducted elaborate cremation rituals for their dead, and nobody saw them. Well, by contrast with the Yahi, the animals around the world seem to require no permanent home or camp, don't seem to have mastered fire, and have a virtually unlimited area of remote wooded and mountainous areas in which to roam. But these giant, hairy beings have been frequently sighted and reported. A persistent question comes up from all this. If the animals really exist, why is there so little physical evidence in addition to cast of huge human-like footprints? Why haven't some hunters found skulls or skeletons? Any accomplished hunter or woods person will answer this question by pointing out that Mother Nature keeps a clean house. The carcasses of the largest forest creatures are soon eaten by scavengers, and the bones, hooves, and antlers scattered. Dr. Ivan T. Sanderson, the late zoologist, suggested that if these mammals are members of a subhuman race, they may gather up their dead for burial in special caves. Dr. Jean Marie Theresa Kaufman agreed that the creatures may bury their dead in secret places. It may be, according to her theory, that they throw the corpses of the deceased into the rushing waters of mountain rivers or into the abyss of rocky caverns. Then, too, it's not unusual for certain of the higher animals to hide the bodies that are dead. Accounts of the legendary elephant's graveyard are well known, and in Ceylon, the phrase "to find a dead monkey" is used to indicate an impossible task. Well, proving the existence of such mammals also seems to many scientists to be an impossible task. And there's always the question of whether or not these creatures are truly physical beings, or if they're non-material creatures who enter our dimension only sporadically for some dark, mysterious spirit world out of time and space. In 1920, the term abominable snowman was coined through a mistranslation of Yeti, wild man of the snow, the Tibetan word for the mysterious creature. For the next 20 years, reports of the creatures were common in the Himalayan mountain range. But it wasn't until the close of World War II that world attention became focused on the unexplained man-like bare footprints that were being found at great heights and in freezing temperatures. Himalayan activity reached a kind of climax in 1960 when Sir Edmund Hillary, conqueror of Mount Everest, led an expedition in search of the elusive Yeti, and returned with nothing to show for his efforts but a fur hat that had been fashioned in imitation of the snow beast's crest. Well, reports of a large ape-like creature in the U.S. and Canadian provinces are to be found in the oral traditions of native tribes. The Journal of Early Settlers and accounts of regional frontier newspapers. But wide public attention wasn't really called to the creature until the late 1950s, and road building crews in the unmapped wilderness of the Bluff Creek area north of Eureka, California, began to report a large number of sightings of North America's own abominable snowman. One story is that these giant human-like monsters tossing around construction crews, small machinery, and oil drums began hitting the wild services. Hunters, hikers, and campers came forward with a seemingly endless number of stories about the surreal, squealing, 7-foot forest giants that had for years been calling with such names as Bigfoot, Sasquatch, Wok Wok, Omaha, or Saskahavis. North America, the greatest number of sightings of Bigfoot have come from the Fraser River Valley, the Strait of Georgia, and the Vancouver Island in British Columbia. The Ape Canyon region near Mount St. Helens in southwestern Washington, the Three Sisters Wilderness west of Bend, Oregon, and the area around the Hoopa Valley Indian Reservation, especially the Bluff Creek watershed northeast of Eureka, California. In recent years, extremely convincing sightings of Bigfoot-type creatures have also been made in areas of New York, New Jersey, Minnesota, South Carolina, Tennessee, and Florida. I know of one case, and if you've never been to Rock City, which is outside of Chattanooga, there are RV camping areas, and one family was chased out of their RV by a Sasquatch who took up residence. Well,
motion detected at the front door.
Reports of Bigfoot-type creatures in California go back to at least the 1840s when miners reported encountering giant two-legged beast-like monsters during the gold rush days. Sightings of the Omaha, as the native tribes called them, continued sporadically until August of 1958 when a construction crew was building a road through the rugged wilderness of Bluff Creek in Humboldt County and discovered giant human-like footprints in the ground around their equipment. For several mornings running, the men discovered something had been messing with their small equipment during the night. In one instance, an 800-pound tire and wheel from an earth-moving machine had been picked up and carried several hundred yards across the compound. In another, a 300-pound drum of oil had been stolen from the camp, carried up a rocky mountain slope, and tossed into a deep canyon. In each instance, only massive 16-inch footprints with 50 to 60-inch strides offered any clue to the vandal's identity. And when the media accounts of the huge footprints were released, people from the area began to step forward with their own plaster cast of massive, mysterious footprints and relate their own frightening encounters with these hairy giants. Two physicians swore they'd almost run over such a monster when the creature stepped out in front of their automobile as they went up Route 299. And a woman and her two daughters reported sighting a large, hairy, two-legged giant on a slope above the Hoopa Valley. Well, in February 1962, at the residence of Mr. and Mrs. Bud Jenkins, they lived about 4 miles from Fort Bragg, California, Robert Hatfield, a logger from Crescent City, was staying the night when he heard the Jenkins' dog barking in fear. Hatfield stepped outside the house and came face to face with a hairy monster that had a human face. He said later the creature had been more than 6 feet tall because it was peering over a fence that was at least 6 feet tall. Believing at first that a large bear had wandered into the yard, he dashed back into the house and woke up Bud Jenkins. Two men rushed back outside, but they didn't see any sign of the big creature, so they raced around the house, each one in a different direction. Hatfield said he turned a corner and collided with the creature. Knocked sprawling on the ground, Hatfield looked up at the strange features of the Bigfoot and yelled at Jenkins to get back in the house. He said that thing was no bear, but something half man and half beast. Hatfield managed to get to his feet and run for the door, and that creature was just a step or two behind him as he dashed into the house. Both men pressed against the door with every ounce of their strength and weight, but they couldn't keep it closed with the howling monster pounding against it from the outside. Suddenly, the pressure on the door eased, and Jenkins ran to get his rifle. Well, when Jenkins came back, the man found that the frightening vista had disappeared, but they found a number of huge footprints that did confirm their story. Well, there's all kinds of stories about the strange and the unusual. We're going to be talking about more creatures of the night, but for now, we've run out of time. And we're going to do a couple of shows on the assassination of John F. Kennedy next week, since that is the anniversary week. So until Monday at 6 p.m., this is Ken Hudnall for the Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening.